does it feel to straddle two cultures? Be the daughter in a traditional Pakistani family steeped in their culture at home, but a modern British girl wearing jeans and t-shirt when leaving the home. For Saima, this was an advantage, as she could see culture from the inside and how other people are perceiving it from the outside. Whereas there are others who say that they found it stressful, as if they felt they could never be themselves. All of us have nuanced multiple identities. That is what makes us unique. Saima Aslam is the founder and director of the Bradford Literature Festival, or BLF as it's fondly called, which she established in 2014. A 10-day literary and cultural celebration, BLF welcomes more than 70,000 visitors to Bradford annually and is celebrated as the most socio-economically and ethnically diverse literary festival in the UK. And I've been there, so I'm testament to agreeing with this sentence. Under Saima's directorship, BLF has made a significant impact on the country's literary landscape, hailed as one of the most innovative and inspirational festivals in the UK, bringing together literature from all genres, promoting intercultural fluency, providing a platform for marginalised voices, and reflecting the changing face of contemporary Britain through a programme which celebrates diversity, empathy, and artistic excellence. Saima, I'm so excited that you've decided to spend some time with me to discuss your stories and share your story, should I say, of unconscious bias. Thank you so much. So let's kick off, Saima. Unconscious bias. How do you understand those words?
Well, firstly, thank you so much for asking me to be on your podcast. It's a real honour. I've always loved when you speak about unconscious bias at the festival. My understanding of unconscious bias, probably shaped by the things that I have seen, is when people treat people differently. And that can be due to gender or race or even based on people's accents, which can be quite funny, but people get treated differently just because of an internalized perception that somebody else has about whatever characteristic that they are judging that person on, what that means to them. And a lot of times it's that what that thing means to them personally, and therefore what they project onto that person from their own sort of internal thoughts.
No, that actually makes sense, that, you know, the fact that the words that you chose, that's internalized, and then we are projecting. And that is so, so true, isn't it? Because what I'm doing, if I use me as an example, I am looking at somebody and purely because of my life story, which is what you're saying, I see you or whoever you might be and jump to a conclusion based on my experiences of what that should be. Yes. And it could be good or bad. It could be good, bad or ugly for that matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we see that around us all the time, don't we? And I think a lot of times, and I think the word unconscious bias is really interesting in this, because there are times when people are doing things very deliberately, but a lot of times these things are, people are really unconscious of it. And with some of the things that happen, if you were to point out to somebody and say, can I just stop you there? And shall we just examine the assumptions behind what you have just said? Mm-hmm. I think people would be deeply uncomfortable.
And most of us probably won't have the presence of mind or the calmness of demeanor to say, hang on a minute, let me just pause there. Can we just go back and ask? We don't do that. And then we walk away, many of us. I might be feeling offended, might be feeling surprised, might be making our own judgments based on what that person has said. So suddenly one little thing has grown and grown. And if only we had the presence of mind to say, can I just stop you there, please? And tell me a little bit more. What kind of stories have you got that are asking you to see, you know, that are influencing you to say what you're saying? I think also this idea of unconscious bias, these two words. I mean, I believe in them, and I love the fact that I'm doing this podcast with those two words. But increasingly, they've become very unfashionable and unpopular. But the irony is the word bias is just a preference. It isn't really a negative word. It's just a preference. And then you don't know that you have that preference for or against something. That's it.
Exactly. And I think it's interesting what you're saying in terms of that, that it has become, and there is a trend for this becoming deeply unpopular. But actually, a lot of our biases, they can be both positive and negative. And some of them, you know, we're all shaped by our life experiences and, you know, how we were brought up, where we were brought up. We can't actually, you know, completely get away from those things. It takes a lot of self-awareness even to move away from them a little bit. So I think we all live with these things. And I think we can class something as, you know, being in fashion at one point and then out of fashion at another. But there are some things which are, they're just part of our fundamental human nature. That is the way we are.
Yeah, exactly. So let's not beat ourselves up about it. But I'd love to hear some stories, Saima. So, you know, as you correctly said, it's about our growing up, our life experiences. So could you possibly share a story of your own?
So one of the stories that I always talk about, because I still look back and laugh, and I could completely understand where it had come from. But I was in my 20s at the time, and I was working for Audi, the car company Audi UK, as their corporate account manager. But my father was, he was in Pakistan at the time, and I needed to, he was having a few glitches with his pension, which I needed to sort out. So I popped over to the job centre to do this for him, and I went very early in the morning, so literally as they opened, because I had a meeting to get to, and it was all taking a very long time. And I said to the lady who was behind the counter, and I said to her, "I'm really sorry, I don't want to be a pain, but I actually have a meeting that I need to go to. And, you know, would you mind just helping me with this?" So we had a chat about what I needed the help with. And she said to me, "Why are you going to a meeting? You have a job." And I was slightly shaken. And then I thought, okay, well, I'm in a job centre. So
that's fair enough, yeah.
I was quite smartly dressed, and I said to her, yes, I have I have a job. And she said to me, "Well done you, that's really very good." And then she said to me, and this is the thing that was quite funny, and she said to me, "Who do you work for?" And I said, "Oh, I work for Audi, I work for the car company." And she said to me, "Oh, do you deliver their cars?" And I said, "No." Don't deliver cars. I said, "Oh no, I'm a corporate account manager for them." And she said to me, "My goodness, you must have gone to university in that case." And I said, "Yes." And we just had this conversation. But I remember walking out there thinking, and I thought, okay, well, I was in a job centre, so I understand the assumption about the fact that I might not have a job. But I think it was the assumption, probably based on, you know, the dealings she had on an everyday level as to the kind of job that I would be capable of having, that made me laugh. So to me, that was an example of unconscious bias, and the way people sort, and we make these assumptions ourselves all the time, don't we? You meet someone, and based on where you are meeting them and the circumstances, you make certain assumptions about them. And to me, and this is, you know, we were saying earlier about how a bias can be both positive and negative. It's actually part of our, you know, unless we made some of those assumptions, we would spend a very long time trying to work everything out. I think that's just part of our natural human makeup.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'm visualizing you there in the job center. And I think you're right, because it is so much about her natural life stories, or her work life stories, that is. She works at the job center. The majority of the people that she is seeing at the job center would be people seeking jobs. That's why they come in. And therefore, it is fair, but there could be much more to it than that. When she saw you specifically, woman, South Asian woman, who knows? You know, there's stories that we don't know, because it's her unconscious bias and not yours that we're hearing about. But you know, you yourself and your life experiences. So there you are, accounts manager at Audi in your 20s, and of course, as we all know, director of one of the best literary festivals in the United Kingdom, the Bradford Literary Festival, which I have been to more than once and absolutely loved. For those of you who don't know, block your calendars for next year, because you've missed this year. But Saima, you know, where have you gone to? Where have you got to? I mean, you've had stories of your own with regard to your own unconscious biases, surely, towards things. I mean, why would you even think to yourself, when I grow up, I'm going to be the director of a literary festival? You see what I'm saying? I'm just kind of challenging you a little bit there.
No, absolutely. I think we all have them. And I probably never in a million years would have thought that I would grow up to be the director of a literary festival, because it was not something that was I had the remotest idea about. And I think, you know, I feel very lucky to have had a journey, you know, a life journey that's actually brought me to this point. But I think one of the things with actually running a literature festival and running Bradford Literature Festival, because of, you know, the where we are based, and part of the remit of the festival is to try to reflect all of the city, all of the district. I think one of the things I've had to be very, very conscious of is the fact that I don't know about other people. You know, I've had to, you know, I can't make assumptions about other communities. I feel, you know, I feel quite lucky in that with the life experience I've had, you know, I've lived in the UK all my life. I feel I have, you know, a certain understanding of certain cultures. I was lucky enough to have a couple of years in Pakistan when I was quite young. So I feel I have like a lived experience that gives me an understanding of some side of the South Asian Punjabi culture. But beyond that, I think one of the things that I found really interesting with doing this work is trying to make sure that when we are creating programs, you don't have that bias. You try not to have that bias. So you try to have the conversations with the people who are in the space that you want to talk about, so that actually it's coming from their perspective rather than your own. Because I think that's the thing with unconscious bias. A lot of times what happens is it's not so much that people are setting out to be, you know, if we're taking this in a negative context, to be biased against someone, or even, you know, but in a positive way, to actually sort of push somebody, one person forward beyond another. I think a lot of times we just don't realize. You have your set of assumptions, and you make that assumption about somebody else. So you have a set of assumptions, so you make an assumption about a community, because actually you have a peripheral knowledge, a surface knowledge. But I think there can be an arrogance in all of us where we think our surface knowledge is the knowledge.
No, you know, you're absolutely right. But there are lots of things you've said here, and I want to try and capture it, just not just for me, but also for our listeners. So, you know, you said more than once, because of your life experiences of being born and brought up in the United Kingdom, but also living in Pakistan for a couple of years, you have a fairly good understanding of Pakistani / South Asian / you know, UK culture from a certain perspective because of these different experiences. But can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because I'm really trying to kind of pinpoint a little bit more about what you're saying. Because you're saying what you don't want to do is make assumptions. And when you're talking to other people, instead of your peripheral, what does that mean, your peripheral knowledge? I mean, can you just give us a real example of what that could look like?
So in terms of, to start with the point about that thing of experiencing different cultures. So, you know, I'm second generation, my parents were first generation migrants. And, you know, that meant they ascribed wholeheartedly to the myth of return. So I was actually born in Pakistan because my mum got pregnant and then went and had me in Pakistan because her family were there. So for the first 8 years of my life, I shuttled. You know, I came back to the UK when I was 4 months old, went back when I was a year and a half, came back when I was 2.5, went back when I was 5, came back when I was 8. And I think what those, and then, you know, I've been in the UK ever since, but I think what those things have meant is, you know, I went to nursery in the UK, but when I came back at the age of 8, I'd lost all my English. So the perception and the way you see a culture at that point is different, but I have my memories of culture of having actually, you know, had those younger years. And I think having gone through my life, and one of the things that I find quite interesting is the way that you are viewed, how that changes with the way that you are dressed. So, you know, I grew up in Halifax. My parents were doing what a lot of first generation migrants do, desperately trying to hold on to this culture that they had in their heads. So if I was at home, I was dressed traditionally. If I was at school, I was dressed in my uniform. If I was with my friends, I was dressed in my jeans. And I have found that when people meet you, depending on how you are dressed, they will talk to you differently. They will relate to you differently. And I think that translates across into other communities. So, for example, you know, Bradford has a really large Roma community. And one of the things that we have done in the festival is we have done some events, you know, with the Roma community. And I'm very, very conscious because of the way people have related to me based on the way that I am dressed, because they have made certain assumptions about me, that it's very easy and in some ways quite lazy to make assumptions about other people because of the way that they are dressed or where you are meeting them at that particular point in time, or about communities, you know, based on just something you might have heard from one person. And to not take that gospel truth. I think there's an anthropological term, which is halfies, where you feel, you know, you have one foot in one culture and one foot in another. And I think the position as a second generation migrant is where having parents who are very rooted in a culture. And like I said, because I was, you know, I feel I was quite lucky to have the time in and out, you know, of two countries that I did for a period of time, because it gave me, it gave me a sense of those other cultures in a way that I wouldn't have had otherwise, because I see it in adults. And I think what that makes you very conscious of is because you can see a culture from the inside, if you like, how other people are perceiving it from the outside, and therefore actually the fact that when it comes to other cultures or communities, you actually are the outsider looking in. And there are certain things that are going to be magnified to you that for that particular community might be a tiny thing. And, you know, obviously, as you said, I run the literature festival, and it's something that we see quite a lot of, you know, the assumption around what somebody who is working class might be interested as opposed to somebody who is middle class or upper class. You see those kinds of definitions.
Of
time, and the assumption, you know, what culture somebody will want to consume or what they will want to do or what they won't want to do. So I think all of those things are, you know, quite big topics in themselves, but they're all
it's utterly fascinating what you're saying, Saima, and I'm completely just sitting here thinking about all the different things you've said here, because, you know, firstly, you talked about the idea of just looking at someone based on how they are dressed, people make assumptions, and then I was also thinking, and I'm really wanting to capture all these fabulous things you've said, and then I was also thinking about the fact that 0 to 8, you were shuttling between two very different countries in terms of culture. I mean, yes, your home culture, whichever country was the same, but certainly the city of Halifax and where you were in Pakistan would have been completely different. And certainly child psychologists say that 0 to 6 are the most crucial years of your, you know, who you are and how you grow up to be. And then, of course, there's all kinds of life experiences that come along the way. So that 0 to 8 that you had would have had some deeply embedded ideas of so many different things that you probably get in, you're influenced by unconsciously without you even realizing, even today. I mean, who knows? I'm no psychologist, but I'm just thinking aloud about that. And then, of course, you know, you talk about even socioeconomic stratas. And so, you know, if it's a working class person, this or what they're in, and the assumptions that we can make. I mean, it's just very powerful, these different stories that you've kind of pointed out to us. But yeah, do go on, Saima. So, When you've, you know, let's think about when you first started out at the Bradford Literary Festival, and you were the two of you running it at that point, I remember. Did you feel that your own unconscious bias might have made you stumble once in a while? Were there any stories that perhaps you can share with us? And then you obviously, with the benefit of hindsight, you've learned from and moved on.
No, absolutely. I think those things happen all the time. And I think the really important thing is just, you know, you have to be aware of these things. And, you know, and we were talking about socioeconomic status, and I think that's something that's actually really, really important. I think, you know, particularly with culture, a lot of these things are money driven. They're not necessarily driven by race. They're actually driven by how much money you have to consume whatever's, you know, coming your way, and therefore what you have access to. You know, we really looked at Bradford's heritage, you know, and it's a city which has had many waves of different migration, you know, Jewish, German, merchants, a really big Irish migration at one point, Eastern European at different points, the South Asian migration. And I think, you know, some of the things you just don't even think about. So I had never noticed, for example, that the Waterstones in Bradford, which I absolutely love, and I tell everybody that it's the most beautiful bookshop in England. The, you know, it has Stars of David all around it, and that was just something just I had never noticed. And Bradford's buildings are just, you know, they're absolutely gorgeous in terms of that heritage. I had made an assumption that actually, because of the heritage that we had, we still had a thriving community, but actually we don't. It was, you know, there's actually a, you know, really tiny community. I think I felt very ill-equipped when it came to programming some of our sort of, you know, content around our Irish communities, of, you know, of rather communities with Irish heritage. And I think it's, I think with some of these things, it's looking at something and realizing how ill-equipped you are because you don't understand it and just and what actually needs to happen, and then extending a hand and asking for help. And I think that can sometimes be the hardest thing. I think the thing that I'm very conscious of, in terms of my unconscious, the thing that I'm very, very conscious of is it's a little bit like when you start reading, and the more you read, the more you realize how much there is to read. And I think it's like that with a culture as well. The more you sort of dig into something, the more you realize just how little you know. And I think one of the really important things is asking for that help with all the things that you don't know. And I think that, that's been my sort of learning with the festival. It's that thing of, I'm very happy to say I know very little about most things.
Well, that's actually, that's very generous of you. Because when you're starting out, you know, people expect you to know everything. You know, you're the director of a literary festival. Excuse me. How can you not know anything? No, I'm just kidding. But you know what I mean. And so I think that's very generous of you that you have the, you have the humility and the self-awareness to know, to ask. I mean, because of course asking is a very important aspect of actually learning about other cultures rather than making assumptions. But yeah, but do share another story. I mean, I think when we were talking the last time, you were even talking about, I think you brought your daughter in. We were chatting about, you know, being a parent and perhaps assumptions you've made about that. I don't know, whatever you like, it's your platform. But I would love to hear another story, Saima.
Yes, I mean, I find, you know, in terms of just finishing up on the literature festival, I think one of the things that I find really interesting is running a literature festival based in Bradford, because people have automatic assumptions about, you know, when I meet people and I say Bradford Literature Festival, the fact that, you know, people don't expect a city like Bradford to have a literature festival, there's an automatic assumption about if Bradford has a literature festival, what that literature festival will look like or who it will program. I think people make automatic assumptions because I'm of South Asian heritage as to what I might want to program or where my interests might lie. And that's both an internal and external thing. I remember having a conversation with my daughter when I was setting up, and I said to her, well, do you remember we went to Oxford and we're going to set up a literature festival? And she said, oh, we can't do that in Bradford. But that was the very assumption that I wanted to change. And I think I think it is really interesting. And I think, you know, I, you know, my daughter's 18 now. She's just sort of gone off to university. And I was actually having a little bit of a reflection last week, because I feel like, you know, I'm at the start of a brave new era now. I keep telling everybody I'm now footloose and fancy free and will have loads of time to do all sorts of things. But I sort of, you know, reflecting back on those 18 years with her and just, I suppose, the assumptions that I made at the start of that journey about what parenthood was going to be like and what I was going to be like. I think I made, you know, I had assumptions about what I was going to be like and what I was going to do. And, you know, the reality can be quite different when you're actually in at the deep end. And I think particularly as a single parent bringing a child up, you have your, you know, the dream list way of the way you want to bring that child up, and then kind of, you know, life clashing with things and the way you actually end up doing things. I made all sorts of assumptions about myself as to how I was going to go through that journey. And then I think I was having a real reflection about how I've actually gone through it.
And I hope you've given yourself a very big pat on the back as your daughter embarks on university. I mean, she's left, as you said. So that's the first stage of the rest of her life, which is amazing. But no, I mean, to me, they're all interconnected, you know, Bradford Literature Festival director, single mom, daughter's just left for university, because, you know, you are all of those things, and more. We're all multi-nuanced, aren't we? But yes, I mean, do share another story, Saima, that kind of reinforces the learning that you've taken along the way in whichever category.
No, absolutely. I think there are a couple of things that for me have been really key and have shaped the things that I have done in my life. One of the things is the fact that when I came back to the UK at the age of 8, I didn't have any English. So, you know, I went to a language centre and I had to relearn my English. I had to, you know, learn to speak English again, read again. I mean, I could, you know, my school in Pakistan had thankfully sort of kept up my written English to a certain extent, but not to the level that I needed it at. And I think what it's made me very conscious of is the potential that every child has and how lucky I was to have a mother who understood the importance of education. And I think the other thing I've found really interesting is how with certain things, people can make assumptions which can end up, you know, and they affect people's lives. So, for example, my daughter has dyscalculia. And we never realized this until about 2 years ago. But, you know, we realized it, you know, and she, you know, she's now at university. But I, you know, was having a conversation with her about one of her friends, and I was thinking, and it seemed quite clear that this person had dyslexia, but it had never been picked up. So they're on a very different.
And what is dyscalculia? So we all know, the listeners know what that means.
Sorry, so it's like having dyslexia. It's like maths dyslexia, I suppose. Yes. Is probably the easiest way to describe it. And I think, you know, and the other thing, you know, my daughter was diagnosed with ADHD and the attention deficit disorder, but part of it, ADD. And then I realised actually it's something that I have. And I found that really interesting because when I actually read into it as to how, you know, it manifests in women and girls, I could see myself. But because I hadn't known that, you know, I had ADD, which I find it interesting that, you know, I think our brain, all of us have brains that work slightly differently. So, you know, I see it as a superpower rather than as a disorder. But there are certain assumptions that you make about yourself. There is, you know, about the way that you either react to things or the way you do things, which are based on what everybody else does. And I think that's the thing with unconscious bias as well, isn't it? Because you are going by, you know, the majority and how the majority act a lot of the times as well. And because, you know, we are majorities or minorities in different countries based on where we are globally, that has an impact. So I think for me, those things in themselves have been quite interesting.
That's a really profound sentence that you've said about the majority and the minority. And I just want to pick up on that and you know, look at it from another angle, because it isn't just about majority, minority, as in you are someone of South Asian origin who lived in Pakistan at the age of 8, who now come back to England. You know, we're all those obvious superficial, if you like, but not, you know, people can see that superficially. But the fact that you may have had ADD, and certainly your daughter has been diagnosed with that, is also the majority minority. So I don't know what the statistics are for people who might have dyscalculia or might have ADD. I really don't know. So forgive me. I'm just thinking aloud about the idea of majority minority. And the fact that you see the world the way you are, right? How you are. Born in Pakistan, shunting between Pakistan and the UK for 8 years, then living here, da 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 da, and then you have a daughter, she's born here, and then you look at how she is communicating, behaving, learning, studying, and because of your own personal way of communicating, learning, behaving, studying, you think that's perfectly normal. And it's only until 2 years ago that somebody says, hang on a minute, perhaps, but what is normal? You see, there's the question.
I think it is a really interesting thing. And I think with the dyscalculia thing, that was something, you know, I wasn't aware of. And, you know, with ADD, so we are now both diagnosed with ADD. And I felt horribly guilty because I had spent, you know, her teachers would say to me about how much of a daydreamer she was and how she, you know, we call it zoning out, what we do where you are having a conversation and suddenly your head just goes completely somewhere else. And so they'd mention all these things to me and I would just say to them, oh yeah, I do that. She's got that from me, without any realization of the fact that obviously that there was something else that was going on here. But to me, that was perfectly normal. it's perfectly normal to get completely lost in something, to be able to very exclusively follow a chain of thought, or to be in the midst of a conversation, or to be quite often doing two things simultaneously all the time.
I see, so that comes back to your majority minority, you see. Because ADD, for those of us listeners who don't know what that stands for, attention deficit disorder, that's what it supposedly, those are the three, third word is disorder. Therefore, it is not common amongst every person. It is more uncommon. Therefore, in inverted commas, it is not the majority, it is more the minority. And so, how people perceive other people based on where you're sitting. So you have ADD, you didn't know that, but you now know it. And then you perceive the people around you based on how you perceive yourself. Do you see where I'm going with this? So yes, it's just fascinating, because even here, at this very basic level of just the fact that you do have attention deficit disorder, that's also part of that is your own unconscious bias, because naturally that's what people do. I mean, how bizarre that you don't do that is what you might be, you don't think that anymore, but you might have done 5 or 10 years ago.
Absolutely. And, what ADD gives you is there are two things. You have a number of things, but one of the things that you have is you have hyperfocus and you have attention drift. And, and it's been very interesting for me to find out about, to actually, I suppose, put a label on it, because I know I hyperfocus. I do that both in terms of, I think, the fact that I run a literature festival, I'm hyper-focused on the festival. I have certain things I hyper-focus on, and there are other things which just drift along. And I have spent a lot of time beating myself up over them, thinking, why haven't I? And then you see this and you think, okay. But it's quite interesting. And it is that thing of, you interpret the world from your own worldview. So for me, the fact that my daughter was, very daydreamy or zoned out or is quite, I think, with that whole thing of having the hyper-focus, you tend to have quite deep, intense friendships and relationships as well. To me, all of that was actually quite normal and natural. And it's not until you actually sort of look at it from the point of view of how, as you say, the majority actually function, that you think, it is not, and I think it's interesting, isn't it? It's the word normal and abnormal.
Exactly. Yeah. Because or disorder. The fact that even the ADD, the third letter is disorder. So yes. That means it's not in order. It's the opposite of order, you see. It just starts making you think about these ideas that people put words on. What is normal and abnormal? Your life is perfectly normal as far as you're concerned. What right have I got to say that it's not normal?
Well, I think this is one of those things, isn't it? And I think when I talk to my daughter, it's the whole thing around neurodiversity and the fact that and one of the things that I sort of say to her, and actually my friend who I set the literature festival up with, her daughter has also been diagnosed with ADHD, and I was in the car with the two of them, and I'm saying to them, well, what you have to remember is the people who think differently, they are the people who create the change. If everybody thought the same, there would be no change, because there would be no different thought processes. And, and I was saying to them, well, who wants to be neurotypical anyway? Neurodiversity is where it's at. And, you've got superpowers, and that's what you've got to remember.
Brilliant. I love it. That's exactly how it should be. Exactly. Gosh, Sam, I could keep talking forever. But so how do you manage? We've talked about so many different kinds of unconscious biases, and certainly you've already told us that when you ask questions, you don't just take things for granted, and you say, listen, I don't know anything, please tell me, I want to learn, which I think is a fabulous, honest, generous way of learning and challenging. But what else do you do to manage your unconscious biases?
I think to me, and it probably applies in most areas of life, I think the most important thing is to try to have a certain level of self-awareness. It's one of the things I say to my daughter. I say to her, you could lie to everyone, but if you start lying to yourself, that's really dangerous.
But how do we do that though, Saima? Because, self-awareness, these are words that we can bandy about so easily. So, but what does that mean? What do we mean by self-awareness?
I think for me, it's actually understanding my motives behind doing things. I think, we all, whatever we do in life, you know, we are doing them for different reasons. You know, some things are, you know, I had my reasons for setting up the literature festival. There were certain things I was really passionate about. And, you know, and that came from my own life experience that, you know, I'm really passionate about everybody having access to being able to read. I think, you know, it's fundamental in life. You can't get ahead if you can't read, if you can't, you know, from an educational point of view, if you can't access the curriculum. And I think every part of the curriculum is closed to you without reading. So, you know, so I was really passionate about that. I was really passionate about creating a change in the images. So, I had my motives for setting up the Literature Festival. And I think...
Just to pause there, because I want to connect that right back to the beginning of the 0 to 8. Because this whole idea, because, you know, we are all... We said, right, and I want to hear the rest of what you're about to say, so forgive me for interrupting, but I want to grab this tiny bit right away, because what we've always been saying is that we are so much, you know, who we are today and how we see the world is our narrative, our life story. And I just want to remind the listeners and myself that because of the 0 to 8 life experience that you had, and then arriving back in this country full-time permanently, and finding that maybe your reading abilities were not as good as your other 8-year-old friends, you must have felt let down, hurt, lesser than, I'm putting words in your mouth, I'm sorry. But you felt it was so, so important. And that's been part of your drive unconsciously, don't you think?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there is a real thing, isn't there, in terms of there, but for the grace of God, go I.
Yeah.
And I have very different parts of my life. And I see that. I think, you know, I was... I feel really lucky to have grown up in the UK in the way that I have. You know, I appreciate the life sort of experience that I have because of it. But I equally see that actually I came back at the age of 8 to the UK, but I might not have done. I could have stayed in Pakistan and my life would have been very, very different. You know, I was lucky I was going to a very good school in Pakistan, but equally I had family members, you know, my family are quite mixed in terms of, I suppose, status and wealth, and you know, and those things have a different resonance in South Asia. But equally, I had family members who weren't. But I was lucky. I was in this really good school, so I was having a really good experience from that point of view. But there are other people who weren't. And then I look at the fact that actually, I came back. I relearned my English very, very quickly, obviously because I'd gone to nursery and I, you know, obviously probably already had that language base. So it didn't take me very long to get out of the language centre and be back in a normal school. But there are other people who were in that language centre for years. I have cousins on my, and I find it really interesting, I have cousins on my mother's side who are, you know, university graduates and, you know, doing great stuff. I have a couple of cousins on my father's side who were taken out of school at the age of 11 and sent to Pakistan. So I think I'm very conscious of, I suppose, all the different trajectories my life could have gone on. And I think it's one of the things when I look at, you know, with some of the work that we do, some of the situations you see people in, and, you know, yes, in terms of agency and what we can do for our own lives, but then there are other things that come along and there are other influences that sometimes you can't do anything about. And I think it's you know, it can be quite, I think the easiest thing is to make a judgment on someone. The hardest thing is to try to understand, you know, that whole thing of sort of trying to walk in someone else's shoes. I am very much where I am because of the life experiences I've had. I have been very lucky, you know, very lucky to have the mother that I have. I was very lucky, you know, I feel lucky to be alive. I was diagnosed with breast cancer at the age of 30. I had a really aggressive tumor. I feel, you know, I was talking to a friend about this yesterday. I was diagnosed at a point when a lot of the medical regimes changed. So I had treatment that I had, I had other help. So I suppose I look at all of those things, and to me, it's almost like, you know, I don't know, quantum physics and multiverses, but all the different lives, you know, that could possibly be lived.
Oh, that's just moving and powerful, and I don't want to add any more to it. I want people just to hear what you've said. Saima Aslam, I am so appreciative of your time. Thank you so very much for sharing your stories of unconscious bias with me.
Thank you.
The This is the last episode of season 5. I'm so thrilled to be able to end with Saima Aslam. As Saima says, the easiest thing is to make a judgment on someone, and the hardest thing is to try to understand how to walk in someone else's shoes. This season, I've had some incredible eclectic conversations about how to walk in someone else's shoes, ranging from the father of an autistic son to a woman minister from Kabul who managed to get out of Kabul before the Taliban took over, a stand-up comedian from India, an MP from New Zealand, and a 93-year-old Caribbean woman who shares her stories on her arrival in the UK in 1946. As always, I am very grateful for the generosity of speakers who have shared their wisdom with us. Season 6 begins in a few months. Until then, do catch up with all these wonderful speakers. Stay safe, stay healthy, and all the very best for the holiday season.